Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Because of the conflict in Ukraine, Europe and Russia are going their different ways. And like a divorce, separation is full of anguish and finger-pointing. The biggest loser of all in this, of course, is Europe. Washington couldn't be more pleased. Its hegemony is being sealed. Crosstalking Russia in Europe, I'm joined by my guest, Adriel Kansanta in London. He is founder of AK Consulting and a foreign affairs analyst. In Brussels, we have Luc Rivet. He's an independent journalist. And in Marrakesh, we cross to Martin Jay. He's an award-winning journalist and commentator. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in time anytime you want. All right, Adriel, let me go to you first in London. As the conflict continues to drag on in Europe, at the behest of the UK, I have to say, and Washington, what is the end game here? What does Europe get out of all of this? Because all I see is a lot of downside and subservience to Washington and to some degree London. London, they left the European Union, but now they're back through the back door of NATO. It's amazing. Adriel, in London.
I think that no one is pretty much sure what is the end game. I mean, the end game, I mean, most people familiar with the case from 2014 until now think that the end game might be, in a worst case scenario, a nuclear war. But people in the West are not, you know, very much keen to pay attention to what Moscow is saying. They are not very much keen to pay attention to what the independent journalists and analysts are saying. I myself most recently conducted an interview with Professor Jeffrey Sachs, who warned at the United Nations that the further escalation of this conflict might lead to the potential nuclear exchange between the West and Russia, but people don't get it. I think that because of the fact that the West hasn't seen war for many years, people somehow don't get it. They've seen it on the screen. They associate war with something that is played on the PlayStation or Xbox. But really and truly, my generation don't know what the war and the consequences of war are. That's why they are ridiculing the position of Russian side, and that's why they are ridiculing this incompetency on the side of Mr. Zelensky. Because this conflict could have been prevented very easily in February if the Western side would have provided guarantees, security guarantees to Russia. But apparently, Russia is not in the position to have the same security rights as other countries in the West, unfortunately.
Well, we've found that out. Martin, let me go to you in Marrakesh. Basically, the same question here, because what is Europe getting out of this conflict, as has been just pointed out, could have been easily avoided, okay? Going back to the December 17th, the two notes, one to the European, one to the NATO, and one to the United States here. Very clear what the Russians wanted, and they didn't take it seriously. So are the Europeans serious now? And what is their goal in pursuing this conflict and backing Zelensky and backing Ukraine that is losing very badly on the battlefield? Go ahead, Martin.
Yeah, I think it's pretty obvious. For me, it's quite simple. I mean, I was in Brussels for 11 years. I understand the psyche of how the top officials there think. I think they want chaos. I think they want a justification, a reason to boost themselves geopolitically and militarily. And this has been on the cards for a very, very long time. You use the word seriously. Are they taking the Russians seriously? We haven't been taking the Russians seriously for a very, very long time. If we look at the timeline and we go back to 1994, where an agreement was drawn up between the EU and Russia, there was a lot of goodwill, a lot of positive thinking, both from Yeltsin, who really wanted to be part of the EU story, and EU leaders at the time. But you know, we lost, I think there's a lot of credibility was lost there. It took 3 years for EU leaders to sign it because of Chechnya. And that was the first red flag. I think the second flag came about a decade later when a number of frontline neighboring countries of Russia were offered some sort of an association agreement called the Network Neighborhood, including Ukraine. That was another slap in the face. And so the, you know, the ignominy just continued for Russia, the humiliation. And then finally in 2014, you know, to offer Ukraine a special association agreement, which is just one step away from accession. I think that blew a fuse. They went over a line. So they were never serious. They were never actually ever serious about taking Russia in as a real partner, as a real player, because they wanted to impose their hegemony on Russia from the very beginning. Russia kicked back on that right from the early days. And I think this is now an accumulation of all that. The situation we have now when we talk about an end game is, I think, the EU itself is capitalizing on this conflict to give itself a boost and to justify a new EU army, to scrap the voting rules so the veto system no longer works. On a shorter term, you've talked about London and Boris Johnson. I think that was very much a play for distraction for him to actually shift the media camera away from a lot of domestic policies which are failing. And to some extent, we can say the same thing about Biden. I mean, Biden's history in Ukraine goes back even before 2014. And, you know, there's a certain bad taste in the mouth there of his geopolitical ventures. So the end game really is to push Russia further away, I believe.
Okay,
so
well, I mean, Martin, that's going to happen. Luke, that's going to happen. I mean, whatever the outcome on the battlefield is, the sanctions will not come down. Okay, the sanctions will probably stay in effect forever. So it's a divorce. That's what I'm calling this program, bitter divorce. So when there is a divorce, Luke, each side gets some assets. What's the asset that, you know, Europe gets? Does it get the house? Does it keep the dog? I mean, what does it get from all of this? All I see is misery. Luke, go ahead.
I wonder indeed what there is in this for Europe. Strictly nothing in my mind, really. Strictly nothing. For America, it's clear. You know, the Brzezinski doctrine was that Russia had to be isolated, and the worst that could happen for the Americans was that Germany and Russia would work together. That was to be avoided at all costs. Well, they've succeeded. They're going to sell their liquefied gas to us, it seems, in the future at a very high price and great profits. So for America, everything's fine. They will sell their wheat as well. But for Europe, nothing. I mean, we lose the source of our energy and we don't sell anything anymore to Russia. So it's awful, the situation. The only thing we gain is a country which is completely bankrupt, Ukraine, with 40 million poor people to join Europe. That's wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Zelensky.
Okay, well, Adriel, I mean, again, the political elite are gaining capital out of all of this here. But, I mean, when France, they're giving out food vouchers, you know, we could see rationing of energy during the winter. I mean, did anybody think ahead? Because I can tell you the Russians have been thinking about this since 2014, after the illegal overthrow of the legal government in Ukraine. So they've thought this all out here. Is anybody thinking it out in Europe?
No, unfortunately not. In my opinion, I mean, I agree with Czech politician, very famous Václav Klaus, who famously recently said that the only statesman in Europe is Prime Minister Orban, who is standing for his country's national interest, and he's the most sober politician in Europe currently. Also, his political entourage as well, who is calling Zelensky out loud, calling him a madman, calling the person that he's having a serious mental problem. But I'm not going to follow that path. What I'm trying to say is that I will disagree with the previous commentator who said that the Europe is getting nothing. What we are getting is a poverty. What we are getting is the Great Reset, as the Davos people are saying. We will have nothing and we will be happy. This is what we are saying. We have a skyrocketing inflation in the United States. We have skyrocketing inflation here in this country, in the United Kingdom. But everyone is using Ukraine as a substitute.
Yeah, but Adriel, but this is just a transition. They keep it's a tough transition. But you know, it's a transition. But it's a transition for whom? They keep the power. They keep the riches, and everybody else gets poor. That's what this Great Reset is all about. Martin, jump in before we go to the break.
Yeah, and how long can it last? You know, we keep talking about this so-called war of attrition, you know, but it's really it's a time game, isn't it? You know, and I think the big question now is how much stamina does the European Union and EU countries have versus what Russia's got in stock? I think we've massively miscalculated this and we're heading towards a brick wall.
Martin, let me say to you before we go to the break, I mean, as we speak right now, there are divisions in Europe, the old Europe and new Europe, you know, as Rumsfeld said. But, I mean, what's going to be after the conflict? I mean, there's still going to be internal contradictions in the European Union? I mean, how do they move forward here when they're not even unified now? Go ahead, keep going.
Exactly. I think division and more Brexit. You know, I see there's really a line right down the middle of the EU countries. You know, on the right, you've got a number of Eastern European countries who are much more pro-Atlanticist and more pragmatic about their role and are very wary about giving Brussels more power, more federalist superpower. And so I think we can see division and more chaos. And how does that translate? That translates at the polls in 2024 to far more far-right MEPs getting seats, which in many ways, you know, any EU mandarin will tell you is the beginning of the end for the European Union. So I see only doom and gloom for the European Union.
Let me jump in here. Let me get to Luke before we go to the break. Reflect on what we just heard from Martin. Go ahead, Luke.
I think we will see a lot of finger pointing between the leaders in Europe, let's say this winter probably, when things get really worse. Now, the cost of the litre of petrol at the station is €2, a little more than €2. But when it reaches €3, there will be a lot of questioning from the citizens getting really poorer by the day, with inflation on the hand, cost of energy getting higher, and cost of food as well. So this is a disaster for Europe.
But Luke, who are they going to blame? Their leaders, or are they going to blame Putin?
They're going to try to blame Putin, but I think the people will not follow this. We will realize more in the coming month that we shot ourselves.
All right. Okay, that's what I wanted to hear. We're going to go to a quick break, and after that break, we'll continue our discussion on Russia and Europe. Stay with RT.
Yo me llamo Alexis, yo soy colombiano, nací en Colombia.
Luego de batalla Spartak, vengo de Italia.
My real name is Zlatko Novkovic. Grew up in New York.
Меня зовут Бен Джеферович, я из Республики Сербия.
Mi nombre es Ignacio Ojeda, soy mexicano.
Все знаете, почему мы здесь, чтобы больше не было нацизма. Наши деды воевали и победили нацизм. Пришлось сыновьям этих дедов снова этого сделать.
Ellos atacaron al Donbass. El Donbass se defendió.
This would not have happened if NATO and Biden didn't push this agenda, this war.
Questa è anche casa mia adesso. Non posso non stare seduto a guardare in aria e aspettare che finisca.
Il fascismo e il nazismo non dovrebbero esistere in nessuna parte del mondo. Entonces es por eso que esté donde esté voy a estar pues luchando contra él.
I'll look forward to talking to you all.
That technology should work for people.
A robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
Show your identification.
We should be very careful about artificial intelligence.
The point, obviously, is to create trust rather than fear.
I would like to take on various jobs.
I mean, with artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon.
A robot must protect its own existence as own existence.
Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing Russia and Europe. Okay, let's go back to London. Adriel, if you look at the Biden administration's foreign policy, it's an unmitigated disaster just about everywhere you look. However, one, and it's kind of a backhanded success, I would say, is that they have unified Europe behind the United States. Now, I posit in watching this conflict is that, sure, America has sealed its hegemony over Europe. Okay. But it's kind of a Pyrrhic victory, isn't it? I mean, that part of the continent is just going to get poorer, more isolated, less productivity, and misery. I mean, what kind of prize is that? It's like 13th-place pink ribbon. Go ahead, in London.
I think that the Biden administration, not United States, Biden administration shot itself in the foot. Because if we look at the polls, whatever polls, whether this is provided by NBC or Harvard University, Biden has the lowest possible appreciation from the citizens among the presidents who are ruling the country. So he's not very popular. But what he's doing is, I mean, he's capable to do this because he's an old man. I mean, he will not be prosecuted for what he's doing. So whatever he's doing, he's doing this in mind that he will not get any consequences for what he's doing, and he knows what he's doing. So I will not say that the Biden administration is mad. No, they are playing according to the plan. I mean, the impoverishment of the American citizens, who are, first of all, now they will be banned to hold guns because they will be demilitarized. So the average citizens will not have the same access to the guns as they used to, apparently. And also because of the fact that they because of their inflation and the gas prices, they will not be able to live to the American standard as they used to. First of all, President Biden and his administration is acting against his own people and also against the people around the world. And at the same time, he's blaming the Putin and obviously the Kremlin.
But if we continue with your line of argument, this means that they just know better than everyone else, okay? Buy your electric car, okay?
This is the neoliberal rationality.
That's right. That's what I'm getting at. That's what I'm getting at, exactly.
This is the rule by the experts. So they ruling by the measures. They see digits and they don't see human beings behind these digits. They are desensitized to the emotions, human emotions. And
oh, but Adriel, they know what's
more than
they know what's best for us. Remember that the Davos ghouls. They know what's best here. You know, Martin, what's really interesting about this conflict is someone pointed out in media is that, you know, most war presidents get a bump in the polls, but there's no bump for Biden. But the reason is very clear why that isn't the case, because it's an elite war. This is not a popular war. This is an elite-driven war. Martin.
Yeah, which you can't win. And, you know, I think the previous comment about Biden being old, which made us all chuckle, is quite relevant. I don't think he's really planning to even stick around to receive the long-term opprobrium from press or from others who will hold him to account for screwing up the economy and, I think, ruining relations with the European Union. You make quite a big deal, Peter, about this relationship between the EU and Biden, and I have to take you to task on this. I don't agree with you. I don't agree that there is this great friendship, this great partnership. I think they're going...
I'm not saying it's friendship. Not at all. Okay, I think it's cold, calculated geopolitics. Keep going.
Yeah, but you're saying it's forced hegemony. It's America basically leaning on the Europeans. They've always done that. You know, ever since I arrived in Brussels in 1995, I was always shocked how all the main international institutions in Brussels more or less follow the Americans on practically everything. It's embarrassing. I mean, it's really shameful. And I think it's part of that, the identity of the EU, which is losing its role as the years pass and losing the popularity of the polls with the fiasco of COVID. I think all these things are accumulating together now to pushing the EU to actually have its own policies, its own independent army, you know, so it doesn't take the orders of Washington. So I think there's a contradiction going on there, but it's never going to end well. I mean, if that division carries on and the European Union gets what it wants, which is more power, federally speaking, then that's bad news for everybody. And I think there's no test case here. There's no There's no experience. There's no track record. It's all experimental. And, you know, when the EU starts making these huge forays into international geopolitics and with supplying arms to a regime like Ukraine, you know, you wonder where that's going to end. I can't see a rosy picture for anybody. I think we're pushing Russia into the arms of China, into India, and I see a new... I mean, BRICS is already there, and BRICS is a success story. But I think it's only going to get more successful the longer this war goes on.
Yeah, Luke, it seems to me, I mean, this whole effort to isolate Russia, all that, it's not isolated at all. And the more the Europeans do this, the more they isolate themselves. I mean, it's so counterproductive for them. Luke, in Brussels, react. Yeah.
Well, if you look at the figures, 84% of the world population doesn't follow the West, doesn't follow Europe and America. So this is the isolation. It's on our side. We are isolating ourselves. We are making sure that Europe will not be leading the world in the future, for sure. Yeah. America might think they will, though China is there, of course, but Europe is really going to the pits. And at the same time, the frenzy of support for Ukraine is fading out slowly here, you know. Yes. For a time, people believed that Ukraine would win this war. I don't know based on what, on declarations of pseudo-experts on TV, but this is fading out. And when winter comes and the difficulties linked to the energy issue, then the questions will come up. And Europe, well, the Eurocrats and the European Commission in Brussels, that is trying to suppress the rule of unanimity in the European Council, yep. It shows how terrified they are of the disagreements
they're terrified of democracy in general, okay? Yeah. I mean, they really are, okay? I mean, what was it during Brexit? Oh, we've had too many referenda. That's, you know, that's anti-democratic. It is, okay? Edward, let me go back to you in London. Now I understand that the Poles have initiated a seventh round of sanctions against Russia. Well, Adriel, why doesn't just Russia sanction Europe once and just turn off the energy? Go ahead. It could happen.
But Russia doesn't have to sanction those people. I mean, they are harming themselves. Russia is just doing its own policy, and rightly so, is concentrating on pivoting away from the West. I mean, it's very rational, and I agree with previous commentators. I mean, Silvio Berlusconi just recently penned an article, opinion piece for Il Giornale, saying that West is isolating itself from the rest of the world, but Russia instead is selling its oil and gas to India, is selling its gas and oil and grain to China. I mean, who wouldn't like to? I mean, they will accommodate. I mean, Russia is a great power. People don't understand. I mean, in the long run, Europe will be harmed, and future generation will remember what this Eurocrats done to us, because it will have a long-lasting impact on this continent. We will be irrelevant in the geopolitical realm or in international affairs. We'll be just as they like to coin it, between Russia and China. We will be a junior partner, or not even a partner, but a servant of the United States, which is losing hegemon. Yeah. So
let me go to Martin. Europe is going to be a junior partner that has to pay steep for energy. And if you're going to have your own army, you have to buy American-made, okay? I mean, every step of the way. Martin, you said in the beginning of the program the Europeans didn't take Russia seriously. Do you think they take Russia seriously now?
I think they have to. You know, they're realizing that Russia's got a lot more staying power. And also, more importantly, I think the point was made earlier, you know, that media is starting to lose its interest in the Ukraine war quite quickly. I was in London last week, and I had a cheeky lunchtime drink with an editor of a national newspaper. I can't tell you which one, but he told me that in the last 2 or 3 weeks, the interest of readers for Ukraine has plummeted dramatically. And I think that's also going to have a bearing on public perception and how we see views. You know, is the EU taking Russia seriously? It will have to at a certain point when people around the world who don't really want to get involved in this conflict, the global south, African nations, for example, who have recently met Putin, you know, those partners who may be forced to choose between them or us will say, no, we're not going to play that game. You know, we don't have the same problem with Russia. And Russia, in terms of some colonies, some former colonies in Africa, has proved to be very resourceful for countries like Mali, who've helped them with internal security, for example. So I think there's going to be a lot of division, and it's only going to harm the European Union that it starts to look like not even a junior player, maybe even a non-player. I think the first casualty in this conflict will be the EU's own diplomatic international department. I think we're going to see the end of this joke, this farce of EU so-called foreign policy. I think that's going to be the first victim, you know. And Russia always was more comfortable anyway talking to EU member states individually, multilaterally. And I think that's just going to enhance, that's just going to increase to the point where no one is talking to this joker in Brussels, Josep Borrell, you know, the man so incredibly boring that when he was Parliament president, there's actually video footage of people nodding off in Parliament sessions.
Well, Martin, apparently he's a polyglot, but I hear he can speak gibberish in seven languages. It's really quite amazing. Luke, we have 1 minute left. Finish off the program for us.
Okay. Well, I think as it was said earlier that the situation for Europe, the geopolitical situation, is worsening. I mean, Monsieur Macron says that we shouldn't humiliate Russia. I prefer the position of Erdogan in Turkey, who is negotiating, who is helping out in this conflict, while Europe doesn't do anything except close doors. I think it's terrible what we're doing to ourselves here in Europe, and people will only start to realize in the coming month, because now it's still propaganda, copy-paste from what Kiev is saying, but it is changing slowly, and I hope it does before
it's
too late.
Well, I think, you know, I like Game of Thrones, and one of the great memes of Game of Thrones is, winter is coming, gentlemen, and it will be felt.
Unfortunately,
I'm sure Sergeant Schultz will be cheering on, you know, the EU and its travails with Russia. That's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in London, Brussels, and in Marrakesh. I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules.